You're listening to the iHeartRadio Talk Network, and this is the Evan Solomon Show.
Welcome to the program. Happy Wednesday. If you can be happy on a day like this, you can be. I mean, we've got a great show. We're going to muck around through a bit of politics of inflation. Yuck. We're going to talk about that. And what can be done about it. I was at the grocery store last night with one of my kids, and my God, prices are crazy. Like, my son eats chicken like it's, you know, Smarties, bulking up. So chicken is so expensive. Everything's gone up. We know that. And now we know today, I mean, they're just putting numbers on stuff that you know when you go to the gas station, you know when you go to the grocery store, you know that everything's going up. But inflation right now, according to StatsCan, is at the highest rate since 1991. Compared to a year ago, and it's 4.8%. That's a lot. And I can tell you something. Whatever governments say, and we're going to dig into this in a minute, inflation is political kryptonite, as well as many other things. It is eating into your wallet. And when something eats into your wallet, when you've got a termite in your house, you are mad at the builder, the landlord, and you take it out on them. So we're going to talk about that. Annual inflation rate, highest since 91. And I could tell you why. There's lots of reasons. StatsCan will go through them. Yes, it's supply chain. Yes, it's COVID. Yes, the weather. Yeah, we've had a crappy growing season. In the U.S., orange juice have had the worst orange crop in 75 years. So if you're into orange juice, get ready. Orange juice is going to be like gold. So there's lots going on. But before I get to that, can I tell you what's on the show? Because there is one guy I think you should hang in there for. Did you ever see the movie Cool Runnings with the great John Candy about the Jamaican bobsled team when he was coaching the Jamaican bobsled team? Well, there's a guy now from named Benjamin Alexander, who's Jamaica's first Olympic alpine skier. That's right. He's going to China. He's going to Beijing, and he's going to be Jamaica's first Olympic alpine skier. He's a DJ. He's 32 years old. And no, he first learned to ski when he was 32. He's 38. He just learned to ski 6 years ago in his 30s. And he was in British Columbia. That's right. This is a guy who learned to ski in BC right here in Canada. And now he's like, okay, I'm going to race for Jamaica. And he's going to. He's qualified for the alpine skiing at the Winter Olympics. So we're going to talk to him. I cannot wait. I cannot wait to be joined by Benjamin Alexander, Jamaica's first Olympic alpine skier. He alone could make me want to watch the Olympics. So even though throughout the show, you might be throwing things at the radio when we talk about grocery prices, and if maybe the trucker vaccination policy at the border when there's protests is driving up the price of groceries, and we'll talk to Dr. Sylvain Charlebois, the food professor, because you got to get the facts right. And even if you end up wasting some good money and throwing a tomato at the radio because you say, I can't believe the prices. And then you might think, well, the war room's here. What is Tom Mulcair going to say? And what is Zane Veljin, Tasha Carradine? Is inflation, house, everything's going up. And you might throw more food at the radio because you're mad at the government or mad at the opposition or mad at whoever. Don't waste your food, by the way. Too expensive to throw. Don't worry, the Jamaican alpine skier is coming. And then you might say, you know what, I need a break from that. I need to meet a hero. And then I'll say, oh, don't worry, Dave Lavery, you know, Canadian Dave, remember him? The ex-Special Forces soldier with the Canadian Army who helped get over 100 people out of Afghanistan in the final days of the Taliban. He was incredible. He was coordinating this incredible rescue. Guess what he did? He escaped with his life, and then in mid-December, he slipped back into Kabul for the first time. That's right. This is a hero. He was on our show back in September, And Canadian Dave is back. He was back in Kabul to help get more people out. What's it like under the Taliban? Dave's going to drop by. Amazing guy. And I know some of you have heard this breaking news about the, you know that Canadian fashion mogul Peter Nygaard? He was just denied bail by the Ontario Justice of the Peace. He faces charges in Canada and the U.S. for allegations not proven in court yet between 1987 and 2006. He's denied all this wrongdoing, but charges of sexual assault and forcible confinement denied bail. Not a lot of fashion going on where he is. But don't worry, Nygaard's just the subject of a class action suit involving 57 women. 57 women! God. 9 sexual-related counts in New York. Come on. He denies it, of course. All right, let's get to the big story. Justin Trudeau's speaking now, and he was asked by my colleague Kevin about inflation. Look, governments have a good answer and a not good enough answer. There's partially true answers, which are sure justifiable, but mind the gap, as I like to say. There's a gap in your answer. The Prime Minister right now is trying desperately to explain that inflation is not his fault. That it is all the result of a worldwide global supply chain phenomena. And he's not wrong. I've done the facts. I always look at the data. If you look at the data, it is true. Inflation all over the world is up. It's not like everywhere is down and it's Canadian, this uniquely Canadian philosophy. Is the Prime Minister right to say COVID choked supply chains, certain weather issues that StatsCan reports that are impacting food have driven up inflation? Yes. Yes. He's not wrong. Give him that. But that's not enough. See, the government cannot just say, look, you can't get credit for a growing economy. And then when you're growing inflation, just say it's not us. Because the buck always stops at your feet. Both the buck you spend and the inflated buck. And Justin Trudeau's answer today, as usual, was, A, we've got Canadians' backs. We've heard that song before. It is no longer on the hit playlist. And let me tell you why. And two, it's not our fault. But let's go to excuse one, or rationale one, depending on what you want to talk about.
The inflation challenge that the world is facing right now is a global challenge linked to, obviously, this pandemic and the path out of it, but also linked to significant disruptions in supply chains around the world. That's why we're continuing to work to be there to support Canadians.
Ah, that's what I want to pick up on. We're going to continue to be there to support Canadians. One doesn't, if global inflation if inflation is a global problem, you can't just say, well, we're always going to spend. And here's the counter argument, sir. Right now, as you are speaking, the parliamentary budget officer, who's independent, did a study, and it's out this morning, and he said, quote, that the federal guardrails on your spending decisions have been met. And your promise to spend another, get this, folks, $100 billion, which is what the budget says, to keep stimulating, says the rationale, I'm quoting, the rationale for the planned stimulus of up to $100 billion no longer exists. You spent $541 billion. And the parliamentary budget officer says, don't spend any more. You don't need it. So, Mr. Trudeau, it's one thing to blame it on the rest of the world, but the parliamentary budget officer says, I'll tell you, there's one thing you can do when you're in a hole, stop digging. You don't need to spend, sir. We're going to pick that up in the war room. Lots to come, but we're going to meet a hero next. Stay with us.
When important decisions are made, we report. Here's Evan Solomon.
You remember Canadian Dave? Just an ex-Special Forces soldier with the Canadian Armed Forces who decided, as he was in Kabul, to help at least get more than 100 people in Afghanistan out as the Taliban took over. Remember that in August? It was the most dangerous, fraught situation. There are terror attacks, chaos, and he stayed in there. And he joined us on the program, and many great journalists, Kevin Newman and many others, were working to help save people. And Dave was at the heart of it. And Dave Lavery is, is an ex-Special Forces soldier, and he's known as Canadian Dave. And he decided to go back in mid-December to Kabul. And he joins us now. Thanks for your service to the country, your ongoing service. First of all, why did you decide to go back, Dave?
Happy New Year, Evan. Yes, and thanks for having me on the show. That's a really quick one. I had to get back, more importantly, to see my team on the ground, to get a better understanding on what's actually happening since we departed on the 26th of August, and try to have a better sense and potentially a start-up relationship with the de facto government, just to see where things are to assist us moving forward, more importantly, with the humanitarian assistance and what we are presently doing. So that was my first objective, but I guess it was a morale booster going back, surprising people, coming in unannounced after about 36 hours, 40 hours later. My main guy, he called the team together at a local place for a dinner, and they all showed up, and they didn't realize I was sitting at the table, and it was a very emotional take back. And I can tell you there was a lot of tears shed.
There was, It must have been unbelievable. Well, give us a sense of life under the Taliban. What's changed, Dave?
Well, I'm not in there day to day, but I'm dealing with my folks day to day. What has changed, and, you know, we have to be very astute on how we navigate what we say, but my venture back in, I had a lot of cooperation with the de facto government, and they were very supportive with my venture in.
So the Taliban knew. It's not like you're sneaking in.
No. You have to, everybody has to understand, I still have a business license. I still have a valid visa until next year, or correction, until the middle of this year. It's just a matter, we just have to rebrand things and rechange. But there was no secrets. We showed up, we met with the authorities at the various departments that I need to deal with, the Minister of Interior, and then obviously the Kabul Chief of Police, the police district commanders. And then we wanted to talk to the folks that are presently occupying our facilities to have a better understanding when they're going to turn our assets and facilities back. So that was one of the reasons I wanted to get back. But more importantly, like I said, it was just to link up with our team and have a better understanding of what was actually happening in the city. There is a desperate state. The economy is really slipping, as everybody's hearing about. It's hard to get jobs. It's hard to bring resources and have financial stability. The government inherited a country rapidly and very fast, faster than they expected. So now they're trying to sort out what they inherited. And obviously there's going to be a lot of unhappy people that want things to happen super quick, and things are not going super quick right now. The economy is in a state, you know, price of fuel is so high that people aren't able to drive their vehicles, which makes it a lot easier. I mean, it was like when I was in Afghanistan in 2001, my first time in driving Kabul. I was senior advisor for the UN for 5 years there. And it was like going back to that time frame, same sort of mentality,
really?
You know, that desperate state of development. And, you know, talking to some key folks, and there are some, some international communities, the UN are doing a great job in talking to the Undersecretary General, or the USG, Deborah Loins, who was the previous ambassador for 3 years in Kabul. She holds that seat, and I had a really good chat with her. You know, and a few other people, and everybody's saying the same thing, Evan. We the, you know, we being the folks on the outside of the country, we need to continue supporting the people of Afghanistan, not necessarily the government that's in place.
Is the government hunting people down like we expected? Is there a vengeance going on? You helped out the Canadians. You helped out NATO. Mm-hmm. We're hunting you down. We're gonna kill you. We're gonna imprison you. We're gonna torture. Like, that was the fear. A mass retribution. Women would have to go back to the burqas. Girls would be out of school. Female judges who had been trained by international judges would be targeted. Is there a violent retribution going on?
Well, let's make it very clear. I can't answer everything what you've just stated, but I do know, yeah, there are certain cases of possibly some of that going on for specific people that are on their watch list. But let's make one thing clear. From what I've seen, you know, in particular to the women when I was there, I seen more women driving vehicles, taxis, you know, taxi drivers. And I saw a lot of women out there, no burqas covered up. They were moving in a liberal state where they were open. They had books under their arms. They were moving about doing things. So in my short visit back, I didn't see that desperate state. In fact, what I saw was almost a little bit of defiance from some folks that they wanted to push the government so far to make sure that they're held accountable for their actions and make things happen for, let's just say, the women or whatever. But I'm not seeing what the media has painted, that everybody's sitting, all the women are in burqas behind locked doors. That certainly wasn't the case when I went back and what I saw specifically in Kabul. It could be different, obviously, in the regions where they're more hard, the harsh reality of what's actually happening and hitting. And then you have to remember the climate and the environment. It's changed. It's winter and it's extremely bad. So from us, I'm one of the partners that are assisting the big picture, the Afghan Strategic Evaluation Team asset comprised of all the generals that you know that are the veterans, from Dennis Thompson, Dean Miller, Dave Fraser, and then the NGO groups such as Journalists, Human Rights, Amalora, VTN has been helping out so much in the beginning getting funds, and then my company, Raven Ray, and ACI, Wendy Long, from the Afghan Canadian Interpreter Initiative. All these NGOs are still kicking butt, Evan.
Are they getting the government support they need, Dave?
Not, you know, and, you know,
because they needed money for safe houses.
They need money. Let's just put it this way. We need more support. The message needs to get out. We need to rub shoulders with the government. The government recognizes us. That's for sure. They understand that we are a professional entity, have brilliant people wanting to do one thing, and that's getting those Afghans that serve the Canadian mission out of Afghanistan and process. But the process is so slow. We have so many people right now backed up, you know, who have applied for the applications, gone through the hoops, and they still haven't heard or received anything back. And that's the frustrating part right now. So we need to get that moving and we need to help that out. But we're very fortunate. We're getting little bits of folks, you know, here and there out of country, you know, with all the appropriate paperwork. You know, we're not doing any secret ops or anything like that. We try to keep everything up and board, and while we're moving and moving folks and helping them get to a third country, etc., so that way the government, those right. folks that are qualified with paperwork, will get the government assistance to fly back home. So we are able to do things, but the message for us, we need to get the government to help out a little more. We need a lot more funds, a lot more support in that area to make things happen, because it's the good people right now that have made this happen, that have been financing this.
I just got a couple seconds. Dave, you going back to Kabul again?
Yes, I will. You know, I'm not going to say the exact date time frame. We've had a very successful mission getting our cats. They were quarantined in London and they're flown into Turkey. So we're going to go link up with our cats after 5 months of this whole ordeal. And then from there, we'll be assessing what date I will be moving back in to meet up with the team and carry on with our business for the future, mostly the humanitarian assistance required.
You got a home here, Dave. Dave Lavery, ex-Special Forces soldier with the Canadian Armed Forces, helped get well over 100 people out of Afghanistan. He's gone back. He continues to be on the ground and helping people out and doing work there and commitment to that country. Dave, thank you, sir. I always respect your service.
Evan, thank you.
That's great. That's Dave. We don't let those stories go. I want to hear from you. what do you think the government needs to do about inflation? We'll talk about that next.
Helping you through these unique times. This is the Evan Solomon Show.
Yeah, they like it. That's what I like to hear. Some music. That's the inflation call-in music. Here's the number to call, 1-855-633-1010. 1-855-633-1010 or 71010. I want your solutions to inflation. You can blame the Trudeau government. I always say, government, you want to take credit for the good news, you got to own the bad news. But if you're going to own the bad news, let's do it smartly. Let's not pretend that inflation is just a Canadian problem. It doesn't alleviate the responsibility of the government. Yes, it's a global phenomenon. Check. Yes, it has to do with supply chains. Check. Yes, it has to do with growing seasons. Check. But as the parliamentary budget officer said this morning, here's something you could do. Stop spending the $100 billion you promised. You don't need to spend it. That is what the independent officer of parliament, the budgetary watchdog, Yves Giroux, said this morning. So here's one thing. I know you like to say, quote, we've got to support Canadians and we've got their back, drink. Maybe you don't have to. Parliamentary budget officer says you don't. Others might say you do. But inflation's the real deal. Now, the Bank of Canada is probably going to raise rates next week. And they might raise, according to some banks, 4 or 5 or 7 times in the next year. Now, it doesn't mean you're going back to the 70s and 80s. You're probably going to go 1.7 to 2%. That's real. That's going up. That's a strong signal. Still historically very low rates because we've been basically negative rates, zero rates. But they're going up. We'll have some cooling effect on inflation. So will supply chains. But, you know, Omicron's a killer too. So I get it. But what does the government do? And who do you blame? Yigal is on the line. Yigal, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Evan?
I'm always on, bud. This is it. This is what I love to do. What's your take?
There's nothing the government can do. You put on the brakes on inflation and you're going to destroy the economy. They pumped so much money into the economy that to do anything now would be disastrous. They spent, you know, over $100 billion on COVID relief. It's artificially inflated the economy. You want to pull the rug out from under the economy by slowing down inflation? It's almost impossible.
Let me give you a couple facts on that, okay, Yigal? They've spent significantly more than $100 billion. They're promising another $100 billion over the next 3 years, my man. They've spent or plan to spend $541.9 billion in new measures, one-third of which are not related to COVID. Most of it's COVID. Over $300 billion. So they've spent like crazy. Now, the PBO says you don't need to spend another $100 billion. You don't need to, quote, keep stimulating. So that's one thing you can do. And does that, quote, tank the economy? Why do you think that would tank the economy?
So I don't know if you heard the interview between Jordan Peterson and Rex Murphy. I think the stimulus or the new measures that they're spending goes to a certain sector of the economy, and that puts pressure on pressure on prices. But
yeah, but know, but let respectfully stimulus. To Dr. Peterson, who's got a lot of views. Again, he's not an economist. I think isn't he a psychologist?
Rex Murphy made the point that there's just not enough oversight when the money goes out. You're talking about stopping new money from going out, which I agree with you, but there's so much artificial money there now that raising interest rates, which is one thing that they can do, is disastrous because it's only money that's inflated certain parts of the economy.
Right. Okay. So I appreciate the call. Let me just answer that. Yeah. Just so people know, I'm not challenging Jordan Peterson, the best-selling author. He's a professor. He's a clinical psychologist. And so, you know, there's many things people may listen to him on. I don't know why suddenly he's an expert on what causes inflation. He has no background in it. I've had on this program, you heard David Dodge, the former deputy minister of finance, the guy who slayed the deficit under Paul Martin, and then he became the governor of the Bank of Canada. I've had the former governor of Bank of Canada, Stephen Poloz, on. I've had the current Bank of Canada governor. These are the people in charge of it. So I'm going to go with the people whose main job it is. And the stimulus, I didn't hear that interview, so I'm not going to comment on other interviews. I will say this. There's a lot of debate about what's causing inflation. There's a multiplicity of factors, global supply chain, COVID shortages. Those are real. That's what every major economist I've ever spoken to says so. So I'm going to go with the experts on that. But there's also an element of spending. Yeah, government spending contributes to it. And that's what the parliamentary budget officer is saying too. So I appreciate the call. Steve, what's up? Steve, you're on the line. What you got something for us? You don't. All right, Steve. Good point. Luther, what's cooking?
Hello, is it me?
Yeah, you got it, Luther. What's going on?
So, you're mentioning some supply chains and other issues related to inflation, but the one issue you're forgetting, which I think is maybe 50% or more of the problem, is corporate greed, right? Big corporations are doing great. The richest among us are doing great. CEO pays have never been higher. And when they want to get rid of stimulus, I don't understand. Ground stimulus is what generates the economy. You give money to people who don't have jobs or to the lowest rung of the economic ladder, they're not putting it offshore. They're spending it. That's how you create a good economy.
So you're saying, slow down. So is your solution saying what? Should you put a cap on CEO pay? Do you want a capital gains tax on the super rich? Are you saying raise minimum wage beyond 15 bucks, like people were talking about, going to 17 bucks? What is the solution here, Luther?
Well, I'm not an economist, but I like all those answers. Like we're in a situation where before COVID and since COVID, the entire capitalistic system that we have is failing us. So what taxes or CEO caps and all that, I don't know exactly, but I know that people who get more money, like as in a minimum wage, they might be able to afford the Big Macs at the restaurant.
Okay, and Luther, listen, you're getting into a really good point. I appreciate the call. The gap between the rich and poor, and we've done this, the gap between the CEO of public company wage and the average worker is going up. There is a huge gap. But today we're talking about inflation. And my question is that really the cause of inflation? And I don't think it is. I think there's lots of other causes of inflation. And is it government spending? Is it supply chain? Is it a combination? People are saying government needs to stop printing money. Can I just say, when people say stop printing money, when you write that, what are we really talking about? The government doesn't print money. I don't know why this cliche gets floated around. The Bank of Canada has something, which is monetary policy, which is independent from the federal government. The government doesn't print money. The government can spend money because they can borrow at lower rates. But I just want to give you the facts. The government doesn't print money. The Bank of Canada does. And they do things like quantitative easing, and they can buy bonds, and they can it's not like they're flooding the market with money. They're making sure that banks have money to leverage. Now, there's lots of questions if that's the right policy. But they're not – government doesn't, quote, need to stop printing money. There's an inflation target of the Bank of Canada, which is 2%, and that's a way to do it to avoid what we saw in 2007, 2008, 2009, the lending markets freezing up and we go crashing like the Great Depression. So let's be careful when we're just, you know, people are saying, Evan, the government needs to stop printing money. I get the bumper sticker. Now, maybe what you're trying to say is rein in the spending. That's a legitimate point. But that's a fiscal point. Printing money is a monetary point. I just want to make sure we're arguing with apples and apples and oranges and oranges. Someone's saying drop the carbon pricing on fuels. It's a fair point. The counter argument would be there's a rebate for what you spend, but fuel prices are massively up. I think interest rates is just going to be suck more disposable income from people and hurt the economy. Yeah, they're going up. We're going to talk more about this. What I want to do is I want to really dig into what's going on our food. What is driving it? Let's understand it. I got the food professor to help us next.
From coast to coast to coast, the newsmakers talk here. This is the Evan Solomon Show.
So what is the cause of inflation? So many of you have weighed in, and I really appreciate it. Like, inflation's rocking. Prices of the gas pump up 33%. I know all those smug people who drive EVs. They're like, you see why we drive? And I know they have to recharge, but man, I'll tell you something. Buddy of mine just bought an electric vehicle. His first one. He got it last week. It's the Hyundai, the Ioniq. Drove it over. Said he'd driven something like 1,000 kilometers or something. And he calculated, because they have a calculator, $35 he'd spent on electricity or something. 1,000 or 1,200 clicks. $35 worth of electricity. He goes, well, how much did you spend on 1,000? I was like, gee whiz. Now, I know he had to wait at one point in Kingston an hour to charge up. But he goes, yeah, like I was just thinking maybe I saved $50 at the gas pump, because he had a Hyundai SUV before. And he said, my wife and I just go out to dinner, spend that. Geez, is it EV time? Let alone on the climate side, is it EV time just on the inflation side? But what's driving inflation in food? I was in the grocery store last night with my daughter. The chicken off the chart. By the way, there wasn't even food on. I was trying to buy fruit. Some things were out. Vegetables out. Like, what the hell was it? It was a Metro. So I gotta get Dr. Sylvain Charlebois on the line, the food professor, because I'm hearing stories that, you know, the new mandate that Canadians have, the Canadian government imposed on January 15th, the mandate vaccinations for truckers, and people were worried that that's going to create food shortages and spikes in food. And so what is causing, are there shortages? Are there inflation in food? Well, the senior director of the Agri-Food Analytics Lab, the professor of food distribution, a good guy. Guy's fearless. He loves his food. Dalhousie University, Dr. Sylvain Charlebois joins me. Hey, food professor. How you doing, Doc?
Good. How are you?
I got to get a better intro for you. Like, I got to get like a food-related intro, man. Like something like...
I thought it was a good intro.
Yeah, I could say something like, he knows his food, but he never serves up a word salad. Something like that.
Sure, I'll take that.
always brings the factual protein. Something like that.
Yeah, that's right. Or, you know, the guy who can bring food for thought or something.
Food for own?
You know, there's always something we can actually talk about, for sure.
Always
every
something
day,
good
something
to chew
on,
not just candy. All right,
give
me something that, first of all, are there grocery store shortages? Are there grocery store price spikes? And if so, what's driving it?
So the answer to your first question is yes. The answer to your second question is yes. Essentially, things are messy out there. And so if you're seeing empty shelves, it's normal for four reasons. One, Omicron. Omicron has completely paralyzed our food distribution systems. You talk to a food company, they're operating with 20 to 30% fewer people around. And these companies are intense, and with less labor around, obviously something's got to give. So that's one reason, and I think that's the big one, really. The second reason you mentioned salads. There was a major recall, a Class 1 recall last week. You may have missed it, but that's why a lot of people are wondering where's the salad at the grocery store. So there was a massive recall from the United States. So lots of salads actually had to exit the market. Third, the snowstorm or the weather. We're in the winter. So obviously in Canada, when there's a lot of snow and you guys got a lot of snow, it tends to slow things down. And fourth, you mentioned it, the vaccine mandate at the border, it's adding fuel to the fire, to be honest. And I don't want to question the reasoning behind the mandate itself on truckers, but in January with Omicron and snowstorms, I don't know.
It's like a perfect storm, right? Someone in Ottawa didn't think things through. It's like a perfect storm. You got a bad season of growing, so you got crops in the United States and in Canada, so you got the weather, you've got supply chains, you've got Omicron coming back, you've got the vaccine mandate on truckers, you got people cooking more at home, so people are neat, you know, everyone's ordering for, there's fear, so people are stocking up. This is a perfect storm for price hikes and shortages.
It is. So, well, we were expecting, so in December, you and I spoke about Canada's food price report. We were expecting food prices to rise as much as 7%. That's not news. So numbers that came out of Stats Canada today weren't surprising, but it's not necessarily food affordability that I'm concerned about, Evan. Right now, it's food access. Access to food in the middle of winter.
Like, what do you mean?
No wonder
like,
put
that on the table.
There were no produce.
What do you mean? Food access meaning what?
Access to food. When you walk into a grocery store, if you're paying more, that's fine. But if you have nothing to buy, that's a problem. Here's the thing. What we're expecting over the next couple of weeks are grocers that could temporarily close grocery stores just because access is a problem. They can't replenish shelves. Why open up a grocery store if half of it is empty? And that's really the problem right now.
It's unbelievable. Like, so am I seeing, when I go to Metro, my local, and I'm seeing that there's things that are hard to find. I was looking for, we were making, I know I got to say this word wrong. I say tacos, but everyone's going to say tacos. We were making tacos the other night. I know, whatever. And my wife's like, hey, we need some salsa. And she likes, I don't know what kind of salsa. She goes, go get the salsa. So I whipped down to the local and no salsa. There, I had to try another brand because it was just like empty. And the there was like tons of, and this is like on a Tuesday, not a Monday, you know? And is that what I'm seeing?
Your experience will be replicated several times in Canada. So here's the message, and I think it's important for your listeners to hear this. You will continue to be able to buy what you need in order to survive. Okay, the problem is that you may not have as many choices as you used to, and your sauce example is a good one. That's a lot more people will experience the same thing over the next few weeks.
I hope people don't stock up, though. Oh, I see there's lots. There's a new shipment of salsa in for my tacos/tacos. I hope people don't start hoarding.
That's the worst thing. It could actually make things worse. In fact, because supply chains are operating very slowly right now, the shelf life for many products that we buy in the grocery store is lessened. So you should do the opposite of hoarding. If you're comfortable enough, if you feel comfortable enough, go to the grocery store, say twice, even three times a week, and buy for 2-3 days. And you'll end up wasting less food because you may actually end up having to throw out too much food. So your savings are actually on the back end, not on the front end in the grocery store where promotions are pretty rare right now.
All right, listen, pal, I'm going to have you back. You're supposed to always be delivering good stuff, but you're delivering the facts. No word salads from Dr. Sylvain Charlevoix. You're the man. I got the war room on the other side of the break, and we're going to feed you with some politics.
You're listening to the iHeartRadio Talk Network, and this is the Evan Solomon Show.
All right, it is time, because it is Wednesday, it is midweek, to get rid of this depressing music and get inside the war room. That music was like I guess when Zane Velji and Tasha Carradine and Tom Mulcair, it's like 2 a.m. They're finished clubbing. They want to just chill out. Tom's like, you know what? I was the former leader of the NDP. I'm a political analyst. I can't get the big bottle of champagne. I want to chill with the music. And Tasha's like, look, I'm a navigator now. Look, I'm a conservative. Yeah, blow it out. We have the freedom, but I can't pay for it because I'm a writer. Let's get the political campaign strategist and partner at Northweather, Zane Velji, to foot the bill. And he's like, yeah, you know, why not? You got to always got to spend to make it, and then they're just chilling, talking politics, 3 a.m. Zane, Tasha, Tom, inside the club.
That's us, inside the club with that lounge music.
Inside the club.
What is that music that we were getting? I don't know what that was.
Let's just pile on Chris. I like this. This is excellent.
See, yeah, Chris is not in charge of the music. There's this. Okay, there's an algorithm out there that puts this music out there, and I feel like the algorithm is on mushrooms. There's something going on.
Which are now legal in British Columbia, by the way.
Is that right? Therapeutic.
Yeah.
There you go.
Well, I missed that, Evan? Someone's rubbing it on the hard drive there, and we're like, chill out. Maybe mushrooms, by the way, I don't know if they're the chill drug. I think they're something else, but we can talk about that. Can we just talk about we're talking about inflation, and let's just get through it, not because it's boring, but we've been talking about it. Tom, the government, I heard Justin Trudeau today, and he says the same thing, you know, like, we got people's backs, and we're working, and childcare. I get it. But and it's a global supply chain issue. Yes, it's COVID. Yes, all that may be true. But in the end of the day, isn't inflation political kryptonite? And my question to you is that answer now good enough?
No, it was good enough 2 years ago at the beginning of the pandemic. Somebody had said back then, you know, if you're going to print all this money, it's going to cause inflation. The answer would have been, we're saving the world and we're saving our country. And that was a pretty good answer. But now people are looking at the highest inflation in 30 years, looking at their grocery bill, you know, just the average family, you know, mom and dad and the two kids, $1,000 right now. Where do you find the extra $1,000 net in your budget when you're already strapped like every Canadian family? Canadian families, on average, don't have more than 2 weeks' pay in the bank. And we have incredibly high household debt. So this is a real thing in real lives of real Canadians. And I think that Mr. Trudeau's answer is starting to wear thin because, first of all, even though I'm a huge proponent and big backer of his plan on childcare, because I think we might have written it into our program in the 2015 campaign, I think that it's not enough for a lot of families, and there are a lot of families who are excluded from that. So he's going to have to come up with a better answer. By the way, François Legault had an even better answer in his most recent budget update. He's sending checks this month. He's sending checks to Quebec families. A few $100. I mean, why not? I mean, since we're in the business of writing checks, let's just send some more money. But it's to cover the inflation that the other checks have caused.
And Tom, I know, by the way, only in politics is political kleptomania disguised as a form of flattery, but you must take it that way when they steal ideas. Tash, what's the answer on inflation?
Well, I don't think it's to send people checks. It's an election in Quebec, election year. Let's not forget that. I think that, the answer, there's no easy one, for one thing, because there's multiple causes. But, yeah, reining in spending would be a good idea federally. And even the Parliamentary Budget Office said that, you know, the so-called stimulus that the Fed say all their spending is going to do and the extension of support programs, et cetera, is not necessary. It's going to fuel this fire. And, you know, it happens sometimes when you look at the inflation rate, you break it down and, you know, one element is more than another. Gasoline sometimes drives it, sometimes it doesn't. But now it's everything. You look at it, everything is up 4.8%. So you're going to get stuck no matter what you're doing. This is an equal opportunity offender. And the government is going to, you know, they're going to see Pierre Poilievre and his just inflation tag all over Twitter again. But it's going to start, I think, sticking because people are, like you said, they're going to have to tighten their belts, and some people can't. And it's a very real personal thing. Mm. So I think the government's in trouble on this. I think they need to show in the budget that's coming up that they're going to be responsible and deal with this from, you know, a belt tightening perspective on their end.
Yeah, and we can get to the politics of it, Zane, because, yeah, Pierre Poilievre is right. He's nailing it in terms of the political importance of it. I think there's a genuine debate if he's diagnosed the problem correctly or not, if he's oversimplifying it. We certainly talk about that, but doesn't matter because the inflation dog is in the room and it's barking and peeing and doing all the bad things that dogs do when they're out of control.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And let's also say that the childcare answer, childcare being a solution to inflation, was categorically terrible from the beginning. I mean, it never should have been part of the script. At the same time, you know, I feel like I go back to some points I made earlier, or actually the latter part of last year, which is Justin Trudeau isn't acting on inflation because it hasn't become a political problem for him just yet. And what I mean by that is that the rationale that this is something international, that this is something out of our collective sort of Canadian control, seemingly has worked well. And we've learned a few things. To one of the points Tasha made here, you know, that fiscal update in December, this government has no indication, at least thus far, that they're going to rein in spending, that the legacy spend is here for childcare, for the housing programs, for the ambitious, you know, big government agenda that this government has. I don't think they're going to rein in spending regardless of what the inflation number is. And I think what changes is if anything that Poilievre says starts to stick, and thus far it hasn't. So I suspect Justin Trudeau is not only doubling down on answers like childcare, he's going to double down on political inaction because it hasn't become a political problem for him just yet.
Yeah, and I think that you're also pointing to an old truism in politics, is that opposition parties don't defeat governments. Governments defeat themselves. And it's not going to start to take hold because Pierre Poilievre is using, you know, his verbiage and his smarmy tactics to try to get people's attention. When people actually start to realize what's happening, what this means in their lives, their kids have a house, everybody scraped together, managed to get a down payment, and the house was at 1.8% mortgage, and all of a sudden it's being renewed at 6.5% or more. And then all of a sudden they can't afford it anymore. That's when people are saying, oh, this is what inflation does. It doesn't just make groceries more expensive. It makes everything more expensive. And then everything else that you've tried to do in terms of social spending, the programs you put in place, like childcare, the carbon tax, things like that, that are necessary absolutely to save, you know, save the world for future generations, those come under attack right away. And then everything that the Trudeau Liberals have tried to do for the past 6 years is right. going to be under attack, but not because of Pierre Poilievre, because the average Canadian is going, well, I'm not sure we're on the right track here.
You are chilling inside the war room late night with Zane Valji, Tasha Carradine, and Tom Mulcair.
I like that.
Tash, can I shift gears here as I pass the proverbial political doobie over to you and ask you, since we're talking about Pierre Poilievre, is he basically now running a leadership campaign? Nobody is talking about Aaron O'Toole. Aaron O'Toole parrots everything that Pierre says. Pierre is basically putting out videos. It's Pierre driving the political agenda. It seems that he's like, look, man, I'm not just stealing this spotlight from the leader. I bought it. And I just feel like there's an open race for the leadership going on right now that no one's talking about.
Well, you know, he's not the only one that could be suspected of having designs on the job. You know, there's been a lot. Patrick Brown, Mayor Brampton, former PC leader here in Ontario, has been tweeting a lot about Bill 21, what a Mayor Brampton has to say about Bill 21 in Quebec. I have no clue, but, you know, I think a lot of people are making statements, and, you know, you might read things into that or not. Aaron O'Toole is, you know, right now, consolidating, I would say, his leadership. We saw the departure of Bert Chen. We've also seen other people within the party say, and I've heard this from them, that he is, you know, really making sure that he is solidifying his circle and being a strong leader within the party. So maybe not as much outside. You're seeing these, you know, the outside voices, but within the party, he is solidifying.
I got 30 seconds, and Zane wants a haul on this one. Zane.
At the very least, he's trying to own the lane. This inflation, economic, fiscal hawk lane is something he wants to own. He wants no competition on it. I think that's what he's trying to do right now. Whether it's outright leadership or not, we'll find out in the coming months.
Okay, let's take a break. You guys chill, go to the water, do what you need to do. We're back inside the War Room Clubhouse. We're going to talk about the art of the political photo op and Doug Ford and digging out of the storm. And if anyone wants to know what the political hot seat looks like for Jagmeet Singh, it's a rocking chair. And the ethics commissioner might be interested in rocking on that. Let's find out next.
Sorting through the changes, here's Evan Solomon.
Welcome back. This is the kind of music that makes me want to essentially flush my head down the toilet, but I guess if you're in the club, that's what you have to hear. That's why I loathe clubs. But we are inside the war room, and we're doing a club metaphor today. So Zane Belgi, Tasha Karen, and Tom.
I'm a big fan of that song.
How much do you hate this kind of throbbing club? Does anyone here actually put that on and think that's what I need ever?
Sometimes.
No.
To be honest, sometimes. this particular song, Darude by Sandstorm by Darude, is just, it's great. Evan, like, it was a chart buster in the year 2000.
No, and I believe me, many things are chart busters that I want to blow my brains out of. The fact that you know this was Darude Sandstorm, which Chris purposely put on, shows that Zane, folks, is the guy picking up the tab today. Holy mac, and I loathe that song. Anyway, but here it is. I just wanted to make sure we started off. Now, I'm going to start with you, Zane, because the art of the political photo op. I just want to say this. Doug Ford was the pluses of Doug Ford, the Premier of Ontario, is he has a brand, and it's a very specific brand that his family's had, and it's the Ford Nation brand. We answer the phone. We're the regular guy. We're there for the little guy. So the big snowstorm hits, and there's Doug Ford with his little parking shovel, and he's out there spending the day shoveling people out. Is it a good thing to do? 100%. It's a very neighborly and nice thing, and it's very on brand. Now, remember, he's polling very low. He's got an election coming up. And I just want to say this. I was asked, did you put that on TV on Power Play, our national political program? My team and I discussed it, and we decided we would not show the picture. And here's why. It was clearly a photo op. His chief communications person was there. Two, we have asked Doug Ford to come on our program since 2019, and he has never appeared. Never to talk about the healthcare crisis, never to talk about anything in Ontario, not once. His health minister has never appeared. There's lots of questions in a crisis to ask. And what he was doing was saying, you know what, I can get attention anyway from these guys, and they'll just show it without me ever having to face a question on CTV's Power Play. So we declined to show it, not because we have any vendetta, or we do show photo ops all the time, but because it was so clearly an attempt to have a photo op. So we declined on our program, and editorial decisions matter. Zane, was this brilliant politics, or was this cheap manipulation?
I feel like it was neither. I mean, with a little bit of a lean to cheap manipulation, you know, what I'd say about Doug Ford is partially what you've said thus far, which is they have a brand. And I think one thing he knows is that for electoral success for him this time, he needs to reown that brand. He needs to ensure that no one else occupies that territory. So while photo ops generally are about being deliberate, they often can veer into looking desperate. And I think the criticism that Doug Ford would face is that this was desperate. This was opportunistic. This was you doing a CP24 interview in your car while driving. You could have done that parked. You could have done that somewhere else. But no, this is about showcasing a brand. And so for Doug Ford, I think the political calculus that his team says, you know, let's take the hits from the people that were never going to vote for us, that were going to criticize us. But at the end of the day, let's ensure we tell all of our political competitors and we ensure that we occupy this populist of the people lane, and no one else can take that away from us. And if that's what they get out of this, which I think they make some inches towards, then I think they're fine with it.
I get why he did it, Tasha. I totally get it. It's super on brand, but like, there are real questions here in a crisis. There's a staffing shortage of beds. We had the head of the Canadian Medical Association on. The Ontario government talks about funded beds. Funded beds are useless. They have to, because you can't staff the 1,000 beds. And one of the reasons they can't staff them, there's questions about Bill 124, which is a wage suppressant thing when nurses need to get raises to attract talent. Just answer some questions about that. I get it's nice to dig out a car, Tash, but doesn't he have to? He's the premier of the whole province. Is that the right thing to do?
It's a total classic Doug Ford thing to do. It's totally on brand with him. And it's, you know, that's why you say it's photo op and such. And yeah, sure, they wanted it to be the photo op of the day. But that is actually what the guy is like and what he does. So it's not off brand for him to do. Yeah. I think he has a bigger shovel, to be honest. The shovel was really tiny and people made a meme out of that.
It was comically small. Like, yes.
What was that? But just so you know, I mean, he's not actually polling badly. He's got a 10-point lead, according to his poll this morning.
Yeah.
So going into the June election. So I think it was a snow day and people were not paying attention to anything except the weather. So I think he went with that. I think from a communications point, it was actually very smart.
Yeah.
Well, I still don't understand
why he did it, Tom.
I don't understand why they gave him a red shovel and not a blue one. But this one was picked up from somebody at York University named John Clark, and it was in the National Observer. I loved it. Great leader that he is, Doug Ford rushes out into the storm to help people dig out. So spontaneous is this magnificent act that he brings nothing with him but a camera crew and a teaspoon.
Oh, that's good.
But
that's
I will say this, look, I understand it. In the politics, we've covered photo ops. I just, and it's his prerogative. I think the difference
is. It's a bridge too far.
But I will say this. I remember when Michael Ignatieff, the liberal leader, thought he'd change his image and he wore like a flannel shirt. And I think the guy had to go to the library to look up flannel shirts before he wore it. And he tried to do it. And it was like, dude. No, that just be yourself. This at least was, as Tasha said, if Doug Ford wasn't the premier, would he be out there? Probably. That's probably the saving grace of it, right?
That's exactly it. And it's that brand that, as you said, Evan, not just him, but his family has owned for decades, and he's not relinquishing that to anybody, election or no election.
Yeah, but I think the thing is, we got to make him answer some questions, though. There's accountability as a premier. Tom.
No, I completely agree with the editorial call. You want to talk to us? Come in. The door's always open, but we're not going to just give you this free publicity because you won't answer questions and you're running for elected office. But at the same time, I never underestimate the Ford brand. You know, his brother was a phenomenon of nature. This guy is too. I mean, they're very Trump-like. I know that that's an easy comparison to make in this day and age because everybody gets the image, but it's true. I mean, he's talking to his base and they're listening to him and it frustrates the heck out of the chattering classes because they're going, well, why are you listening to that guy? You know, he's got nothing. And the answer is because I like him. I like what he's doing. And that's what's going on here.
Okay. So listen, no surprise. He's done it. And there you go. But I also always say we cover policy, not photo ops. Jugmeet Singh's wife, who's an influencer, hashtag what the hell is that? But anyway, she's an influencer, so they get paid to push stuff. She was given a rocking chair as a gift. Credit to CBC for breaking this story. $1,800. She's supposed to post it on Instagram, but instead, there's Jugmeet Singh rocking his new baby in it. That, to me, is the political hot seat. He says he's going to pay for it. It was a mistake. How bad is that for him, Tom?
In the world of Canadian politics, when you can go to Aga Khan's Island, get blasted by the ethics commissioner and basically walk away from it, it's small potatoes. And it shows that the NDP, you know, is not immune to this sort of analysis. And good on Jugmeet Singh for recognizing right away that it was a real problem. And maybe there'll actually be a slap on the wrist from the ethics commissioner. But it also reminds people, and when you're in politics, you know this, you're not the only one who's being shackled when you go into politics with rules that continue. I'm finishing the fourth year of my 5-year ban on direct lobbying because of the office I had. So you're also dragging your family with you. You know, there are restrictions on everybody around you. So everybody always uses the same expression. A lot of sacrifices when you go into politics, but not just for the person being elected, for everybody around them as well.
Well, once that ban's over, let it rain on the Mulcair. No, just kidding. But
join shop, Tom. We've got a spot for you, Tom.
But Tasha, did Jugmeet Singh misinterpret Neil Young's song, Keep on Rockin' in the Free World?
And it's just what's going on?
Wow.
Well, at least he didn't play that in his background music on TikTok and do, you know, the baby and the rocker.
Right,
I think. Yeah. What this is to me is interesting because, you know, Sophie Gregoire Trudeau wore a lot of Canadian designers, right? When she was first, when Trudeau was first elected, she was known and those pictures were replicated everywhere. The difference being, though, yes, she was helping promote a brand, but she wasn't taking the photo herself. Mm. She wasn't influencing people directly. This is different. And so for Jugmeet Singh to do it, but also for his wife, it puts her in a situation where influencer is now a job. I mean, this is a thing and this is how she earns her living, but there's a bleed there in terms of.
I got to rock around. I got to leave the club.
You got to rock around.
I'm going to clap the club. I got to close the club. Tom, Zane, and Tash. We got a poll coming out about jailing the unvaccinated, which you want to stick around for.
Yeah.
making sense of the latest news. You're listening to The Evan Solomon Show.
Welcome back to the program. We have debated a lot about attitudes towards the unvaccinated. Look, the unvaccinated are taking up a disproportionate number of beds in ICUs and hospitals. You know that. You know that there's a health contribution slash tax the unvaxxed proposal in Quebec. But John Wright and his team at Maru Public Opinion, the polling company, decided to measure attitudes towards the unvaxxed. Would it be acceptable to deny them health care, even a short jail sentence, literally? Well, guess what? To find out, this is like the cover of the National Post stuff. John Wright, the executive vice president of Maru Public Opinion, joins us. First of all, before we get to the data, let's get to the real stuff. How are you? How's the fam? What's going on?
We're great. You know what, Evan? We had COVID visit us through our university student who came home at Christmas time. So we dealt with it close range. Three of us did not get it, but we masked up and locked down. But you know what? I got to tell you, a 6 foot two, completely stacked young man with all the nutrition in the world, was felled for about 2 days with 106 degree temperature.
Are you serious?
Oh yeah, it was.
And he's double. Was he double vaxxed?
Yep, double vaxxed, and it hit him like a board. And I got to tell you, he works out every day and drinks all. You know these kids; they drink all the right food, you know, with the right shakes and foods. But yeah, it nailed him. I'm really glad that, especially with the 106 degree temperature for that period of time, we were that close to going to the hospital. And I suspect there are others who are getting it more mild, but to call that mild, I didn't think so at the time.
Yeah, well, my cousin, very healthy. My brother, very healthy guys, triple vaxxed. My cousin's triple vaxxed. He had to go to the hospital in Toronto, and he had to get a steroid. He didn't stay in the hospital, but the doctor said, I'd never seen a triple vaxxed person so sick, but he's fine. My brother, triple vaxxed, like your son, was sick. But yet my brother's wife got it, his daughter got it, they were fine. So you just don't know, right? It can wallop one person and the other person's like, I got the sniffles, no problem.
And that kind of ties into the poll that we're dealing with today, because even like if you take the last four pieces that I've put out, they primarily have dealt with, the healthcare system and how things are across this country. And what you find is, you know, people now believing that because of the unvaccinated, the majority believing that it's a de facto withdrawal of service. Now, you look into my family and into others, you'll see that there are people who are pushing off either surgeries or even cancer treatments because they've been suspended. And this is where the grind is now coming, where we're getting the impetus for retaliation or punitive measures against those who are unvaccinated. I'm not sure how far it would go, but there is a degree of angst out there where people are saying, you know what, if you're not double vaxxed and you're not towing the line, well, then maybe you should get to the end of the line and maybe you should pay some kind of penalty.
So let's get to the hard numbers. Canadians, let's start at the headline. Like literally, how many Canadians are supporting? I don't support this. I'm not pushing this. But literally jail time for the unvaxxed?
Yeah, running through this, and we tested a whole series of different scenarios, and it is the minority where you'd find 27% who would accept that kind of thing. And it's to serve up to 5 days as part of a jail sentence for endangering others or overwhelming the healthcare system. I mean, you will find this pretty much average across the country. But the majority
of the population says they'd be okay with 5 days of jail time for not being vaxxed. Wow.
Yeah, look, I think what's running through this are two groups of people. The first group fixate on a lot of the punitive measures, just like I've said. So you will get, 37% saying that they should not be allowed to have access to any publicly funded hospital or medical services. 33% who say that they refuse the renewal of their driver's license, and then the punitive one dealing with jail. The rest of the public that piles on, however, then goes to the healthcare system and believes that you should pay a monetary healthcare surcharge or have them pay out of pocket. it then escalates to the last one, which is pretty wide open. And that's what we're dealing with now, you know, restrictions. So you can see how this divides into most people saying that what we're dealing with now is okay. Another 6 in 10 who are split between, you know what, we should charge them for something with respect to the healthcare system, and the other half saying, look, we got to screw them down and it's got to be much more punitive.
So the Quebec idea, the health tax, got a lot of support.
It did, and it didn't waver. We did one poll that was undertaken about a week and a half ago that showed 60% support across the country, and it was acceptable in British Columbia and in Quebec the most. And we did it this week, and it was at 61%, so it hadn't moved at all. So people, again, when you reflect on all the research that's been done, believe that there is a de facto withdrawal of service from the healthcare system because of people who are refusing to get vaccinated. And as a result, they are turning now to the collective healthcare system that we have. I looked at exact numbers that come out of the United States because I polled at the same time there. 23% refuse to get vaccinated, but they are far more punitive. I mean, they have a private system as opposed to a collective public system. And it's kind of like, you know what? You want to not get vaccinated, you're on your own, pay your bills. Here, we don't have that. And I wonder whether or not at some point we're going to start having that debate that, you know, if you are going to take up space and you haven't done what everybody else wants, whether or not you are going to have to pay out of your own pocket in a different way.
And John, you've nailed it. I mean, that's what Quebec has opened the door. What are you going to do? Make smokers pay more? Make people who eat fast food who have a higher BMI, like, come on, like, this is going to open up a proverbial can of worms. But if you were looking at this overall, people are quite, like, looking at your poll, John, they're pissed off at the unvaccinated.
Oh, man. And again, you have to take it in context with some of the other polling that we've done. You've got, you know, 83% of people across this country that know of hospitals that have shortages. You've got, you know, close to half the population indicating that they haven't been in to see their doctor in the last period of time, or that they know of someone with serious illness that have not been able to get them treated. I mean, what we're focusing on right now is the hemorrhaging of a healthcare system that's in run by the public. And there's only one way in, and that's one big lineup, and there's only one taxpayer paying it. And so that's where the point of concern is the most right now, that this is the de facto withdrawal of service to the rest of the people who in fact have done what they believe the right thing, and they can't get treated for all the other stuff beyond COVID.
It's also, you know, these attitudes can quickly swing out of control. People on either side start weaponizing these things. We got to be, you know, as Rudyard Kipling used to say, you got to keep your head when all about you are losing theirs. Like, steady on here, folks. Like, there's a lot of anger. But you know, when you say in your poll, John Wright, from our public opinion, when you say 37% say it's acceptable to deny publicly funded healthcare, and then the majority, not just most people, you're talking about 2/3 of Canadians in favor of a mandatory vaccine. A mandatory vaccine means the government's going to force you to take a vaccine. That is dangerous stuff. Like, I am a triple vaxxed. I have no sympathy for the unvaxxed. But mandatory vaccines, no government has purported that. I know they floated it. No one said that. You are getting into some big time civil liberty stuff.
Well, yeah, and I know, you know, I've been doing polling for a long time, as you know, and I don't shy away from asking some of the questions that, you know, either side wants to see in this. I think, though, it's a complicated issue because it involves human life. And you can understand that there are people who are obviously attitudinally predisposed one way, that they don't want a group of people to kind of stop us from getting back to some normalcy or having the healthcare system clogged up. But there were a lot of people who believe that either they or their relatives may be denied that kind of healthcare service that they need now. And they could point fingers and say, if you don't open up, then go to the back of the line.
John Wright from Aru Public Opinion. What a poll. Fascinating. The great insight, as always, from our friend John Wright. Hey, I'm glad your family's healthy. Take care of the home base. Everything else is just another piece of data.
Absolutely.
But your family's your family. John Wright, Executive Vice President of Aru Public Opinion. What a great guy. Thanks, Johnny.
My pleasure. Take care of him.
What a good guy. All right, you guys want to smile? I promised you're going to love this next story. Jamaica's first Olympic alpine skier is going to join us. That's right. Cool Runnings Part 2. This guy's amazing, and he learned to ski in Canada. Check this out next.
As your world changes, we adapt to get your answers. Now more with Evan Solomon.
Benjamin Alexander is about to make history as Jamaica's first Olympic alpine skier. That's right. Jamaica. Alpine skiing. Now, we love Jamaica for many things, but no one has thought about alpine skiing. But remember the John Candy film, Cool Runnings, about the Jamaican bobsled team? Well, that was an inspiration for Benjamin Alexander, who first learned to ski 6 years ago at the young age of 32. And he joins me now. Benjamin, how are you?
I wonder how many people look at that and they're like, wait, is this a typo, 32 instead of 2?
I will tell you this, Benjamin. When I heard you strapped on your skis in British Columbia at 32, I'm like, the dude is nuts.
Hey, but listen, at least it was Canada.
So tell us the story about how you became, how you are now Jamaica's first Olympic alpine skier. How, like, you live in the UK, you learned to ski in Canada. Put the pieces together for us.
Yeah, well, I kind of live all over the world. I haven't lived in England since 2006. I consider myself a global citizen. I've been spending a lot of time in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. But prior to being an international, well, prior to being a ski racer, I was an international DJ performing in over 30 countries across 5 continents, which is kind of like your typical career path, right?
Totally, of course. Ski racer. You always start. Every skier takes the international DJ path.
Exactly. Well, there is one guy, Manuel Feller, who's a really good Austrian skier that's now making reggae music. So maybe, you know, it's a two-way street. Anyway, in 2015, I was invited to go to a heli ski lodge in British Columbia called Mica, and just to hang out with my friends. There was about 25, 30 of them that were going to go skiing, and there were maybe 4 or 5 of us that were just going to be the house cats chilling in the lodge, which is a beautiful setup. And on one of the days, they flew us house cats up to the top of the mountain to join the skiers for lunch. And at the end of lunch, I saw these, my friends, turn into superheroes when they put on their powder skis and just disappeared off the ridgeline. And I had no interest in skiing prior to that. And at that moment, I just thought, let's do this. I want to be a skier. So it was 2 months later. I was DJing in South America, and I was flown up to Whistler to perform, and decided to get my lesson. And that would have been family day 2016. So when I'm in the starting blocks in Beijing, it won't even been 6 years yet. It'll be 5 days short of my 6 year anniversary.
And were you good? Like, now I'm going to be clear. When I was in high school, I used to make money on the weekends by teaching skiing. And so I've taught a lot of people how to ski, and I can tell you, they suck often at the beginning. Were you any good?
No, I sucked as well. But here's the thing. After that lesson, I went out and I decided to choose one green run and go down it. I fell 27 times on that first run on the green run.
Oh my God.
But I graduated with an engineering degree, and we have a way of problem solving, and we just tried to remove as many variables as possible. So I stayed on the same slope, and I just kept maniacally repeating it. And that number 27 for me was just a baseline, a metric to work against. And I slowly got it down to 7 by the end of the day. And this whole project has just been about slowly getting better and stepping towards the goal.
By the way, I like how you drop other awesome jewels in your life. Oh, by the way, I'm not just an international DJ. I'm also an engineer, and now I'm an Olympian. I just want to know what's next. Oh, I don't know if you heard my hit single, the number one in the club charts. Okay, so
I'm trying to follow the guy from Dos Equis. Do you know that advert?
Yeah, exactly. The most interesting man in the world. Benjamin Alexander, the most interesting man in the world. Benjamin, now are you a Jamaican citizen?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I have dual citizenship.
Now, so when did you decide, did you know about the film Cool Runnings? Was this an inspiration?
It was the coolest thing since sliced bread when that came out when I was 9, 10 years old. But I can't say there was a direct line. If there was a direct line, then I would have started skiing 20-something years ago, right?
Right, right.
It was definitely the movie and the fact that as the quote-unquote black representative for my group of predominantly white ski friends, they would keep making this Cool Runnings references and the jokes about Jamaican on ice, you should go to the Olympics. So I went to the Olympics in 2018 as a spectator and didn't get to see any alpine skiing, but I noticed that there was only three athletes representing Jamaica in a country that's such a powerhouse in the summer games.
Yeah.
So something didn't compute, and I started digging a little deeper.
So now you're going to the what did it take to qualify for the Olympics? I'm not sure whether you're the most interesting man in the world or the craziest. I'm going with the former, but you could be the latter. What did it take to qualify?
Yeah, I'll take the latter on that bet. Look, the International Olympic Committee wants to have as many nations represented in the Games as possible. I think I checked today and there's 85 alpine skiers, which is 85 nations in alpine skiing. And so they set a minimum threshold for the country to send forth one athlete. For the ski racers that are listening, that's five fifth results under 160 points, which without getting into the boring technical details, if I had started skiing at 2 years old and ski racing at 5 years old, by the end of my first year of kind of proper racing at the age of 16, 17, I should be at that level. So I'm basically trying to catch up with 10 years of ski racing and a lifetime of skiing in 2 years and 6 years of skiing.
But now, can I ask you a serious question? Because there's a lot of good ski racers and many of them may be listening. Do you suck still? Or are you actually like, you know what? You will be surprised. I'm actually pretty damn good.
I'll tell you something. When you know nothing, you think you're great at something. And as you know more and more and more, and as you improve and you're 10 times better than what you were when you thought you were good, you realize you suck more. and so I don't want to take anything away from the amazing ski racers that your country has,
right.
The people that have been doing this for their entire lives. Those guys are in a completely different stratosphere for me. You know, their family have been putting $50,000 into their tuition and their coaching every year since they were 7 years old. The National Ski Federation has been putting $100,000. They show up with 20 different skis, a full-time ski technician and a full coach, and I'm showing up with one ski. And so I'm not competitive against those guys, but that's not what this is about. It's about inspiring other people from the Jamaican, predominantly diaspora. You know, there's a lot of Jamaicans in Canada,
nice.
80,000 just outside of Toronto. And across Canada, the U.S. and the United States, the United Kingdom, there are 2 million, almost as many as there are in Jamaica itself. So it's about inspiring those guys to dream big and to start earlier.
Dude, just because I got to let you go, although I could talk to you forever, because I think you are the most interesting man in the world. You're going to compete in the giant slalom in Beijing. You know that's bloody dangerous, right, Benjamin?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. I'm excited by the danger. So let's go with the, when we said former or latter, I'll take the latter again.
Yeah, I know as a DJ, there's a lot of ecstasy. Don't do it before you race. You know that, right? I'm telling you,
comment.
Don't do it before you race, dude. I don't want this to end with you thinking you're skiing and you're not. You're hugging one of the flagpoles.
Crazy things have happened. 10 years on the road as a DJ, crazy things have happened.
Listen, Benjamin Alexander, Jamaica's first Olympic alpine skier. You've already inspired people. I really genuinely think you're on the right path. You're such a great ambassador for the sport to open up the inclusion of it. The Olympics should be about this. Humans doing their best, trying their best, trying to inspire others. There's too much cynicism. You've made me want to watch and cheer for you. Benjamin Alexander, good luck. I hope we speak again, sir.
Me too. Take care. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you too. Benjamin Alexander, that's Jamaica's first alpine skier. Good luck. He's a great guy. He's an engineer. He's a DJ. Good luck, right? How great is that? I told you he'd make you smile. What a great guy. Hey, thanks for listening, everybody, on the Evan Solomon Show. I'll see you on Power Play tonight at 5 p.m. Eastern on CTV News Channel.